books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today I'll talk to New York Times best-selling author Jason Reynolds about his Carnegie shortlisted book, 24 Seconds From Now. Plus, we'll listen back to Eric Motley talking about Madison, A Place of Hope. All that, plus we'll find some new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Before we start today's show, though, some news from the ARIAs. I'm afraid Read On is still an ARIA nominee. It was a great night and a great honour for Read On to be nominated for an ARIA, and it was great to be in the room with so many amazing names from the world of audio and radio. The speech entertainment category covered both radio and podcast, and considering we were among only 10 nominees, that's a huge honour for Read On. RNIB Connect Radio has also been nominated for awards in 2024 and 2025, and of course, you may remember we won Community Station of the Year 2 years ago. So, here's the next year, and on with today's show. Jason Reynolds is a number one New York Times best-selling author of many award-winning books, including Look Both Ways, A Tale Told in 10 Blocks, All American Boys, and was last on Read On with his Carnegie shortlisted book Long Way Down. This year he's back on that list with his book 24 Seconds From Now, which is narrated by Jason's longtime collaborator and friend, Guy Lockhart.
I swear, if there was a category in the yearbook for ugliest dog ever, you would have no competition. None. It'd be you all day. Because you, ugly. I mean, them eyes alone are enough to win the superlative. All wonky and whatnot. They somewhere between half sleep and fake mean. Somewhere between madness and madness. Glaring at me like we got some kind of problem or something. But let me be clear. Your crooked look don't scare me. Neither do them cement chips you got for teeth. Look at you. Most likely to scare nobody. Or at least not me. What I look like being worried about some stringy-haired mutt with an underbite severe enough to double as a bottle opener? Or Halloween fangs? Or whatever else is supposed to give off scary but ain't scary at all. At least not to me. At least not tonight.
24 Seconds From Now is this a story about a young man named Neon and his girlfriend Aria. They've been together for 2 years and they love each other dearly. They're seniors in high school. School is coming to an end soon. And things have progressed, right? The natural order of things. And now they're in this space where they feel like they're ready to take the next step into their first sexual experience. And the boy is having lots of feelings, whether it be apprehension or concern or feelings of inadequacy or anxiety. And it's just a story about how do we take a love story and unfold it so that we can explore the interior life of the young man in this moment.
Tonight ain't for fear or for your face. Tonight is for us, me and Aria. Aria and me. Tonight is for the winners of the superlative, which is most likely to like each other the most, love each other the most, and do the most, or more than usual. For each other, with each other. Tonight is for our first time, and will be our first time. Together. 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 And I'm ready. ready. I think I'm ready. I am ready. Except, for some reason, I'm still jammed in this bathroom, having a square up and a stare down with you like we enemies in a cowboy flick or a hood classic. Which are basically the same, except for the color of the characters and the hats they got on.
Why is it you don't think we see many stories from the young man's perspective?
I think as a, and I almost think this is a global phenomenon. I just don't think that young men's emotional landscapes are often valued, except for when we're trying to figure out a way for them to stop being violent, right? So like we love to talk about young men in violence, young men in anger, young men and this idea of the pent up emotion, but it isn't a holistic concern, right? It's like, we just want you to stop being violent, right? Or we want you to stop being angry. But I think what has to happen is there needs to be some interest in all the pockets of our humanity, right? We should be able to explore and express all the corners of our psyches. And some of those corners are the ones that require a certain level of vulnerability. And those vulnerabilities then require a certain level of safety. And I feel like young men don't feel safe because the world does not actually create safety for them. And because the world doesn't create safety for them, young men then create unsafe places for everybody else.
Now, because you brought it up, let's talk about violence. I've seen an interview with you saying that reading will reduce violence.
My thoughts are that it isn't the reading itself, it's what reading does, right? And what reading does to the brain, which is lots of things, right? It teaches discipline. I'm talking about the soft skills. It teaches discipline and persistence and concentration. It teaches you how to listen, how to finish what you start, how to comprehend, how to think critically. But to me, one of the most important things it gives you is vocabulary. And the more vocabulary you have, the more words you get to choose from, the more likely it is that you'll be able to better express yourselves. And the better you can express yourself, the less likely you will feel the need to be violent. It's that simple, right? Like, it's not so simple, but it is that simple. More language, more emotional expression. More emotional expression, less violence.
Now, the book does deal with sexual things. There's a lot of bravado at that age around sex. People have got pornography in their pocket, basically, on their phone. And you address that in the book. I believe that was the same way your mum addressed porn to you.
Yeah. I was probably a little younger, actually. I was probably 15 when my mom had the same conversation with me. And the conversation was a simple, you know, it was simple for her. It was really embarrassing for me. But this idea that my mother knew that I was watching pornography, and in that moment, me feeling shame and her sort of curtailing that shame, her saying like, no, you don't need to be ashamed. You just need to be careful, right? Like, I'm not trying to shame you or embarrass you. I just want to make sure that you understand what it is you're looking at, because what you're looking at is not an accurate depiction of a sexual relationship, of a healthy sexual relationship. What you're looking at is theater, right? This is a circus. This is an act. These are paid actors who are performing, literally performing. And I don't want you to assume that this is what you are expected to do, because if you assume that to be true, then you will be harmful. And then she also said, but at the same time, I want you to explore your own sexuality, explore your body, get to know yourself so that you have a healthy relationship with your own pleasure. And to then reinforce that there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the feelings of wanting that. And so I'm really grateful for that conversation.
Tell us about the structure of the book, how it goes back in 24 increments of time. It starts off with seconds and eventually months. How did that structure come about?
I mean, to be honest with you, I had to figure out a way to not write a sex scene. So if I start the book right at the moment, in which they're about to engage sexually, look, I love writing for kids, but I am not a child, right? I am a middle-aged man who, without a shadow of a doubt, does not want to write a teenage sex scene. One, because it's just not something I'm interested in. And two, because I recognize that as a man, and this is one of those weird things, right? As a man, I don't know what it is, what that sort of energy is, or what, like, I know that me writing that would feel a little icky. Now, if one of my women counterparts wrote it, not so icky, right? Judy Blume did it. Lots of people do it. I don't know if it reads the same. And it could be because of my own sort of blind spots and like my inability to get it right. It could be, or maybe I could have gotten it right, but still it would be colored a particular way. And all of that felt a little bit dangerous for me, even though I'm an artist and I'm supposed to just di I, look, yes, I'm an artist, but I'm also a responsible adult making work for young people. So I have to consider all of the variables here. And so I said, okay, I don't think, and to be honest with you, the sex isn't important. Right? The sex isn't the important part. The important part is figuring out how we got to this moment and unfolding the story in a way that allows for the young boy to be unfolded too. And it made sense to then move backward in order to do that.
Like an old movie where the camera turns to the fireplace.
Exactly.
Now, I listened back to your chat on Read On in 2019, and I was surprised that you said your first proper book, the proper book you read, was at the age of 17. Now, what was the book, and why did it take you that long?
The book was Black Boy by Richard Wright. And it took me that long because this is the 80s and 90s when children's literature wasn't nearly as vast and diverse as it is now. And if you're a kid growing up where I was growing up, there were certain things that I was looking for in my stories, right? I'm looking for my neighborhood, which means the families on my block that acted and looked like my block, the noise of it all, the fact that this is the 80s and we're dealing with the crack epidemic in America, we're dealing with gangs, we're dealing with the beginning of HIV and AIDS, and we're dealing with the beginning of a new music that's taking over young life and you know, like what it meant to be a black kid in America at that time, which was hip hop, right? All of these and then we also have the three mics going on, right? We have Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson, Michael Tyson, and they're huge pillars in our culture and in our community, especially as it pertains to being a black boy at that time. And I'm looking for any semblance of any of those things in the books that they were giving me in school, and none of those books had anything to do with any of those things. And so I stayed away. Felt like reading wasn't my thing because it felt like I wasn't ever considered in the making of the books, right? My life wasn't a life worth writing about. And so it just took me a while. Now, when I read Black Boy, it wasn't that Black Boy was directly connected to my life. By that point, I was a little bit older. I was 17, almost 18 years old. I was in college already. It was more so about the book being absolutely entertaining. That the second page of the story, our main character sets the curtains on fire in his grandmother's house, right? And like, we're gonna burn the house down accidentally. That was sort of epiphanic for me. Like, oh, a book doesn't have to be boring. Oh, it could get exciting right at the beginning. I don't have to wait 50 pages. I don't have to have all this expository writing, this expository language in order to get to the actual good part. And that's what hooked me. But the reason I didn't read before that is because, and I hate the word representation. I don't hate it, but I think it's become a bit milquetoast. But it really was about representation, me not being able to see myself represented in the stories.
So you're writing the books that you wish you had at the time.
Every day of my life.
Are you surprised that books written mainly for black kids in America are so popular in the UK?
Every day of my life. But you know, I am, but I'm not. You know, there's a one, our cultures are very similar, right? Like black kids in America and black kids in the UK are very similar. The other thing, though, is that like these books are about black kids, but they're for whoever can find themselves in these books. It doesn't have to be a black kid. You know, you don't have to be a black child to connect to these stories. Everybody knows what it feels like to be afraid. Everybody knows what it feels like to love, right? Or to desire love. Or to desire tenderness, right? Everybody knows what it is to have a friend, hopefully, right? Or to know what it is to not have a friend and to feel betrayed. These aren't racial or cultural, right? This is just the part of the human experience. The details are cultural, but one of the strange things about America, and there are many strange things about America, is that I would argue that our greatest export is Black American culture. I think Black American culture is something that the whole world knows about. Whether they know about the parts of it that are complicated or the parts of it that should be celebrated is a different conversation. But I think the world, especially the young world, knows, or at least feels like they have some semblance or some grip on what it is, on what Black American culture is. They may not know Black American life, but our contributions to the culture, right, our music, our clothes, our style, all of that stuff, I think, has been exported around the world.
Now, many of the books on the Carnegie list over the years have taken place in magical lands with fantastic creatures and things. But for you, I think that the magic is in the everyday, the magic is in the mundane.
I mean, to me, that's where the magic is in my real life. I understand fantasy and I understand magical worlds. It makes perfect sense to me to want to exist in a space in which you can see yourself or project yourself into a story where you get to slay the dragon. I get it. It makes perfect sense. I just also think that there's so much magic in the real world. There's so much magic in our everyday lives, right? Like if you see two kids on the street doing a secret handshake that only they know, and that handshake is choreographed and 30, it has 30 steps to it until you get to the end, that feels like magic to me. A magic that perhaps only they understand, but it feels like a magical thing, right? To see, double dutchers on the street playing jump rope and moving in a way that feels almost impossible to move. Feels like magic to see mothers make miracles happen by keeping their families safe and supported and fed on very, very, very little feels like magic, right? It's like all of these things feel magical to me. And I think it's just about our perspective and the way that we view these things that'll help us extract the magical moments.
You looking at me, head cocked like we got beef over turf? Like you got an issue with me being here, even though this isn't even your house no more. Still, I can hear you yapping in my ear, trying your best to mess this up, blow the mood. And that makes me feel ridiculous because you ain't even here to interrupt me and Aria. You ain't even here to get in the way. You just some picture stuck in the metal frame of the medicine cabinet mirror, curling at the corners. And yet I swear, if there was a category in the yearbook for worst distraction during an important moment, you'd also win that one.
Now, through the magic of editing, the listeners will have heard a clip of the audiobook as narrated by Guy Lockhart. Now, I would usually ask if you had a hand in the casting of the book, but I know you and Guy go way back.
Yeah, I mean, I've known Guy since I was like 14, right? He's one of my best friends, and we've been doing this for a long time, and it allows me to not have to worry about it too much. I can make the thing, and I know that he knows the jokes, that he was around for some of these real moments, right? That he gets some of the inside jokes, and that he knows the tone, right? And what this story is supposed, how it's supposed to feel. And so I feel very fortunate in that way to have had a partner like that for so long to work on my audiobooks for with me. And yeah, it's been an amazing journey for the both of us.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the audio version from RMIB is the cover. Could you give us a description of the cover of 24 Seconds From Now?
Oh yeah, it's just a oh yeah, it's a yellow cover, and I wanted to make sure it was the same cover over there. It's a yellow cover with two teenagers, right? A boy and a girl. Who are their back is to the reader, their back is to us, and they're holding each other, just walking down the street. He's got his arm around her, she's got her hand in his back pocket, and it's a very easy, familiar, comfortable, intimate drawing that is undeniable, right? It's one of these weird things where it's so subtle and it's so normal that it feels magical. If you can feel their relationship jumping off the cover of the book.
It's also got that wee dog that gets quite insulted at the start of the book.
Yeah, I know, right? That's right. You're right. You're right. I forgot. There's also a little dog running beside them. You're right. There's a dog, and that dog is a huge part of the story. It's a huge part of the story. And there's reasons I use the dog. That's a whole other conversation. It's a symbol for other things, but there is this dog that they co-own, basically, that they share. His name is Denzel Jeremy Washington, and Neon hates this dog, and Aria loves this dog, and I like thinking about what we would do. Like, what do we do for the people we love? What can we put aside for the people we love? What kind of discomfort will we allow for ourselves for the people we love? What concessions will we make for the people we love? Who or what might we love in relationship to the people we love? And I think that dog represents Neon's his compromise, his tenderness and sensitivity toward this woman, It represents their puppy love. It represents their sexuality being something that is shared and not given or taken. It represents the fear and anxiety around all those things because Neon is terrified of them. This idea that a thing could be cute and ugly, that it could be kind of goofy and strange looking, all of which is what young love and young sexuality is. And I think that's sort of a few of the layers and meanings of the dog.
How much of Neon reflects you?
A lot. I think a lot. I was a little more advanced than Neon at that age, unfortunately. But my I love love, man. I love partnership. I loved having someone to walk down the hallway with at school with my arm thrown over her shoulder. I loved sort of kissing in the corner and writing notes. And like I was one of those people. I loved that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I also was a kid who had, because I was young, I was a kid that was younger than everybody else around me. I was 2 years younger than everybody in my class, right? So when you're a kid that's young, that's that young, you also sometimes posture and you feign a kind of maturity that doesn't actually exist. And so because I was young and I didn't want to be bullied or teased, I acted older, and which meant that I costumed myself. I pretended to be and do and know things that I did not No, and it got me in a lot of trouble and put me in really precarious situations and had me doing things a lot earlier than maybe I wish I would have done them, just trying to pretend that I was somebody that I wasn't. So I understand Neon's anxiety. I understand his insecurities and his feelings of fear and desire. So I would say a good chunk of Neon is in me.
Because I'm definitely distracted. Standing here in my underwear, curling at the corners too. At least that's what it feels like. And I wish curling up was the only feeling I'm feeling. But it's not. I'm feeling stuff. More than I think I thought I would. More than anybody ever said. For instance, how come nobody told me my fingers would tingle or that my face would burn? Why nobody said I would feel all the blood in my body? Feel all my veins spark like electrical wires from temple to toe. Like fireworks under my skin. How come nobody said that just before I connected with my girlfriend, she, who I've seen almost every day for the last 2 years, would look exactly how she looked the day I met her? That all of a sudden, my eyes would reset.
24 Seconds From Now is available commercially as an ebook in print and in audio. It's also available in audio and braille from RNIB. And Jason Reynolds, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll hear more from Jason Reynolds later on in the show in Books of Your Life. And coming up later, we'll also hear from Eric Motley about Marison, A Place of Hope. And next up, we'll get some brand new books in the RNIB library. That's coming up after this.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. Some of the feedback received by the Talking Book Studios over the years can be a bit unusual.
We get a lot of fan letters from our readers. We get a lot of thanks from our readers as well, which is really lovely to hear. I remember one story. One gentleman wrote to us, complained about the books we were sending him. We used to put a little asterisk by the catalogue number when there was a warning put onto the book, you know, warnings that there was bad language or some passages that may not be considered suitable for family listening. So we used to put a little warning on it on the recording, and we used to put a little asterisk by the print catalogue so people, if they saw that, they could say, well, I don't want to listen to that. And we had one gentleman write to us and say, I'm disgusted. Every single book you send me, from beginning to end, it's full of filth. Now, you do notice what I've said there, from beginning to end. So he read the book first, then decided to complain about it. What we discovered lately is that he wasn't selecting the books, his carer was selecting the books, and she thought these asterisks were books that we were recommending.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303
03 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. A Slow and Secret Poison by Carmela Loukas was donated by Penguin Random House.
8th of February 1923. We put Charlie in the ground today. It seems heartless to write, but I could not move myself to cry, even as I cast my parting handful of dirt onto his coffin. I think I lost the ability to grieve over the past decade. Perhaps some things are diminished through practice, rather than grown. This was true of the number of mourners. There were barely 10 of us present in all. Just compare that to the 200 or so people who descended on Harford for my parents' funeral. If only someone had warned us then that we would need to ration them out for what was to follow.
1922, Wiltshire. When V. Morgan accepts the job of gardener at a crumbling stately home, she's hoping for a fresh start where nobody knows her troubled history. But Harford Manor is shadowed by grief and the memories of long-faded glory. Its rooms haunted by the only surviving member of the family, Lady Arabella Lashie. V is fascinated by her enigmatic new employer, a woman obsessed by the curse she believes has killed her family one by one, a curse that is coming for her next. As V immerses herself in the world of Harford, she finds herself increasingly entranced by Arabella and the secrets that poison her. But V has her own things to hide, secrets that caused her to flee Cardiff. Secrets that estranged her from her own family. Secrets that might finally catch up to her.
Then again, who among us would have believed such a warning? Not Charlie. Cheerful, optimistic Charlie. Even when I read the signs so clearly, he refused to listen, shrugged his shoulders, or looked at me with concern, as if I were the one who should be worried. I wonder if he changed his mind in those last moments, or if, even as he came off that bloody horse, he still thought it all unconnected. I will not make the same mistake as you, my sweet brother. Poor Morrie managed a few tears. He has always been such a tender soul. He will probably cry when we shoot the wretched horse, too. Mr. Allen wants to sell it. But I cannot stand the thought of the thing getting away scot-free. Not that it is the horse's fault. The Reaper was always going to come calling for Charlie, and the creature just happened to be his instrument on this occasion. I wonder what he will send to collect me. It did not really dawn on me until the both of us were standing there in the graveyard. Morrie honking into his handkerchief while I held the umbrella, that we are the only ones left. Our whole family tree stripped down to two little twigs. How lonely we have become. There's mine, I told him, nodding to the bare patch of earth next to Charlie. Then yours after me. The church tower seemed to look down on us, waiting, no doubt, to watch us go under. I can't stand to look at the thing any longer. I keep imagining ways that I might die, from the improbable to the mundane. Will it be a falling tree, a sudden cancer, a smouldering cigarette thrown carelessly into the waste paper bin one night? Beneath my show of bravado, the truth is that I am terrified. As much as I try to tell myself that it is inevitable, that I must make my peace with it and wait in resignation as the hourglass fritters itself away, I do not want to die. It is as simple as that. So I must cling to my one consolation, I am not like Charlie, or my other brothers, or our parents, because I know what is coming. I see the distant headlights on the road. If there is any chance to avert their path, then I swear on Charlie's grave that I will take it. I am so very tired of funerals.
A Slow and Secret Poison by Carmela Locus is read by Beth Eyre and Jade Kroot and runs for 10 hours 59 minutes.
The Invisible Woman by James Patterson was given to us by Penguin Random House.
My name is Eleanor Gilbert, and I am the Invisible Woman. No, not the kind that can make a deck of cards look like it's shuffling itself. The other kind. 2 years at the same dry cleaner, and he still asks my name when I drop something off. 5 years at the same drugstore, and I doubt the pharmacist could pick me out of a lineup. My kind of invisible isn't fantasy or science fiction. It's real. It happens slowly over time, and you won't even know it's happening. Then one day you're in line at Whole Foods feeling good about yourself and your healthy life choices, a cart full of plant-based ground meat, oat milk, fat-free yogurt, and organic broccoli, and deftly hidden under all that a chocolate fudge cake that serves four, when some guy scoots in front of you. So you say, very nicely, "Excuse me, I think I was next." And the jerk says, "Oh, sorry, lady, I didn't even see you." Say what? That's when you start to notice how things have changed. Those annoying wolf whistles from construction workers that you found so demeaning at the time? Gone. Those makeup ladies in Bloomingdale's who tried to spritz you with the latest "Oh, to something new and fabulous"? History. Sure, those nice-looking guys on the bus are still there, and they still try to catch your eye. But now, it's to offer you their seat. Somehow, when I wasn't looking, I seem to have passed my sell-by date. And there's nothing I can do about it. Well, except for that chocolate fudge cake.
Once a top FBI agent, Eleanor Gilbert had faded into obscurity, facing uncertainty in middle age, her past mistakes casting long shadows. But when a call from her former boss offers a shot at redemption, she can't resist. Her mission, infiltrate the opulent world of a New York art dealer suspected of laundering money for a notorious drug cartel. Suddenly disguised as a grandmotherly nanny, nothing can prepare Eleanor for what she encounters behind closed doors of his brownstone family home. Surveillance is second nature. Babysitting is not. But as the risks increase and dark secrets are unveiled, she also develops an unexpected love for the young charges she's hired to protect. Can she betray the trust of those who have come to depend on her to get the job done?
The Griddler is technically a coffee shop, but the staff lets you sit for hours even if you're not working on a screenplay. Another plus? They make a great Cobb salad. Huge homemade croutons, chunks of free-range roast chicken, and a giant crispy X of bacon across the top. My waiter today, Desmond, takes my order as if he's doing me a favor. My guess is he's an actor wannabe, hoping to be noticed by all the screenwriter wannabes nearby. He's sized me up and decided I can do nothing to further his career. But a simple snub won't spoil this glorious Sunday in early October. As I nurse my last glass of summer rosé, something Eleanor Roosevelt once said pops into my head. No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. That Eleanor, what a trooper. She had a mother-in-law who hated her and a skirt-chasing husband who humiliated her with a gaggle of willing women, and one in particular, Missy LeHand. His tall, beautiful, very public private secretary who, according to rumor, made FDR's Warm Springs summer cottage quite a bit warmer.
The Invisible Woman by James Patterson is read by Marnie Pinning and runs for 7 hours 24 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
That number again is 0303 123 9999. And we're heading to Alabama with Eric Motley after this.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Let's take a journey from racially charged Alabama to the Oval Office with Eric Motley. His book, Madison Park, A Place of Hope, is narrated by Brandon Maloney.
The years 1964 to 1972 were turbulent for Barbara Ann. As fate would have it, her struggles coincided with the political and social upheaval rippling across the country. Barbara Ann rode the wave of black students integrating Robert E. Lee High School and, in 1973, was among the first to earn a diploma from the formerly all-white school. She eagerly looked toward her future. But in 1972, when Barbara Ann was 18, she found out she was pregnant. She gave birth in a Tuskegee hospital a week before Christmas, bringing her newborn home to 34 Motley Drive in Madison Park. They called me Eric.
A clip of Brandon Maloney reading from Madison Park by Eric Motley. And Eric joins me now. Eric, tell us about the book.
Well, the book is a story about a place in Montgomery, Alabama, the American South. It is a story about how a group of freed slaves organized themselves, having very little, having not long been emancipated, and how they desired to create a community. And they acquired a plantation, they purchased a plantation, and they created a community, the spirit of a community. And it's really a story about the place, how it came to be, how it was founded by these freed slaves and their aspirations to live into the fullness of the American dream. It's a story about my own personal journey and how my life intersected with the people in that place and how those individuals and their descendants came to have such a meaningful impact and impression on my own development and evolution. And then it's really a love affair, a story about a love for a place and a people and what takes me back and what I've taken with me from that place.
And your journey itself is remarkable as well. Tell us about that.
Well, I left Madison Park. I had some academic challenges early on. People in the small town organized themselves to help me to accelerate and to reclaim my academic status or to reclaim my academic commitment to learning. And then I went off to college, Samford University. Had a great experience there. I got a Rotary Ambassadorial Scholarship to go to the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. I was there, and during the course of that 1 year, I fell in love with the place. My appetite for learning increased, and so I stayed on and did a PhD. And then I left from there, and I went to the White House, moved back to America, Washington, D.C., got a job at the White House, worked for President Bush, and was there for about 4.5 years. And then I went to the State Department and worked there for Condoleezza Rice and Dina Powell. And then I left from there, and I went to the Aspen Institute, and that's where I remain, which is a public policy organization in Washington, D.C., nonpartisan. A think tank is a public policy organization. It's where a lot of people who are former secretaries of state, former cabinet officials and foreign ministers and domestic ministers go to work after their years in government to continue to try to find solutions to very complex societal problems. And so we're nonpartisan, neither Democrat, neither Republican, and we work at bringing people together to try to find some common ground and to try to find the best solutions to those complex issues.
Now, you talk about some of the characters in the book, like Aunt Shine and the guy who was stealing gas.
Yeah.
Are any of those people still around? And did any of them witness the end of your journey?
Oh, my gosh. You actually read the book or listened to the book. Wow. Aunt Shine was this muscular woman, muscular in faith and physique. She was strong in character. And she was a person who intervened when I was failing academically. And she designed a plan for me to have what I call resurrection. And she ended up having a very important role in my life. She ended up dying while I was at the White House. So she lived long enough to see me go abroad, get a PhD, come back to the U.S. And, you know, one of my last conversations with her was, if you're satisfied because you have a PhD, if you're satisfied because you now work at the White House, then I'm disappointed in you. Because it's not about having achieved those things. Mm. It's about achieving your own sense of place in society and discovering how you can give back in a way that improves the lives of others, right? So none of this investment that we've made in you is about your professional development. It's about your human development, the human material. Alan Sowery, oh my God, he was the guy who siphoned gas from his car in the darkness of the night.
It was from his car, right?
Yeah, it was from his car.
He wasn't stealing it.
No. He was siphoning gas from his car to put in my grandfather's car because my grandfather didn't have enough gas once a week to drive me into the city to participate in youth programming at the YMCA. And my grandfather would have made way. He would have found the resources, but Alan Sowery wanted to do whatever he could to soften the blow.
Yeah.
And so we never knew, I never knew that that actually took place until one day when I bumped into a local community character who was drunk. And he asked me for some money, and I gave him some money. And then he said to me, oh, by the way, did you know the story about how I would always push the car up the driveway, Alan Sowery's car up the driveway, so that it could be parallel to your grandfather's car? And I was a guy who had to siphon gas from Alan Sowery's car to your grandfather's car. And Alan Sowery gave me 50 cents to push it up and 50 cents to push it down. Alan Sowery had long been dead. And so I never had the opportunity of saying thank you to him. He never had the opportunity of actually seeing what that investment, that little investment that he was making, would manifest itself into in my life. And so in many ways, this book is an expression of gratitude to those who are and to those who are no more. I went back to Madison Park about 3 weeks ago to bury and to eulogize a 90-year-old person who was my childhood hero, Dr. Winston. And I went back, and of course I saw all the friends, all the old neighbors, but most are gone.
Yeah. What's the full title of the book, and why did you call it that?
I wanted people to know the name Madison Park. You know, there's a very fancy restaurant in New York called Madison Park, and it's a 5-star restaurant. And it's a place where to get one course, you're paying almost $200, right? And so friends of mine are always saying, have you been to Madison Park? You got to go to Madison Park. And I like to say, there's another Madison Park that's very different from the Madison Park that you're talking about. So I wanted to put the place in people's mind. But the name of the book is Madison Park, A Place of Hope. And it's called A Place of Hope because in 1880, those freed slaves had nothing except dreams and aspirations, faith in one another, and hope. And I believe that what has made Madison Park work and survive is a relentless commitment to hope, a relentless commitment to seeing the promise and to looking on the other side of the challenges that we have, realizing that we all have the ability to create the conditions for something better. And so I believe in hope.
Eric Motley, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you. It was a real honor.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Jason Reynolds, author of 24 Seconds From Now, for the books of his life. What was the book that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, the book that made me fall in love with reading. It might have been that first one, Black Boy by Richard Wright. But, you know, after that, I read so many things. It was a gradual. It wasn't one book. It was a series of books. You know, reading Black Boy opened me up to reading in general. And then I started reading all these books from the 1970s, like Black writers from the 60s and 70s. That really just kind of broke me open. And then I started reading Walter Dean Myers, who is a huge children's writer over here. And once I started reading him, I knew that I was good to go.
Hunger stole upon me so slowly that at first I wasn't aware of what hunger really meant. Hunger had always been more or less at my elbow when I played, but now I began to wake up at night to find hunger standing at my bedside, staring at me gauntly. The hunger I had known before this had been no grim, hostile stranger. It had been a normal hunger that had made me beg constantly for bread, and when I ate a crust or two, I was satisfied. But this new hunger baffled me, scared me, made me angry and insistent. Whenever I begged for food now, my mother would pour me a cup of tea, which would still the clamor in my stomach for a moment or two. But a little while later, I would feel hunger nudging my ribs, twisting my empty guts until they ached. I would grow dizzy, and my vision would dim. I became less active in my play, and for the first time in my life, I had to pause and think of what was happening to me. "Mama, I'm hungry," I complained one afternoon. "Jump up and catch a congry," she said, trying to make me laugh and forget. "What's a congry?" "Is what little boys eat when they get hungry," she said. "What does it taste like?" "I don't know." "Then why do you tell me to catch one?" "Because you said that you were hungry," she said, smiling. I sensed that she was teasing me, and it made me angry. "But I'm hungry. I want to eat." "You'll have to wait." "But I want to eat now." "But there's nothing to eat," she told me. "Why?" "Just because there's none," she explained. "But I want to eat," I said, beginning to cry. "You'll just have to wait," she said again. "But why?" "For God to send some food." "When is he going to send it?" "I don't know." "But I'm hungry." She was ironing, and she paused and looked at me with tears in her eyes. "Where's your father?" she asked me. I stared in bewilderment. Yes, it was true that my father hadn't come home to sleep for many days now, and I could make as much noise as I wanted. Though I hadn't known why he was absent, I had been glad that he wasn't there to shout his restrictions at me. But it had never occurred to me that his absence would mean that there would be no food. "I don't know," I said. "Who brings food into the house?" my mother asked me. "Papa," I said. "He always brought food." "Well, your father isn't here now," she said. "Where is he?" "I don't know," she said. "But I'm hungry," I whimpered, stomping my feet.
Black Boy by Richard Wright is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as read by Peter Francis James. What's your comfort read? What's your rainy day reread?
There's a book called Love That Dog by Sharon Creech. I read that book all the time. That, and there's another book called Salvage the Bones, which is not a kid's book, but is about a teenage girl during Hurricane Katrina by Jesmyn Ward. I love, 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 love that book. I could read it every... I mean, that's a book that I think is perfect.
China's turned on herself. If I didn't know, I would think she was trying to eat her paws. I would think that she was crazy. Which she is, in a way. Won't let nobody touch her but Skeet. When she was a big-headed pit bull puppy, she stole all the shoes in the house, All our black tennis shoes Mama bought because they hide dirt and hold up until they're beaten soft. Only Mama's forgotten sandals, thin-heeled and tinted pink with so much red mud seeped into them, looked different. China hid them all under furniture, behind the toilet, stacked them in piles, and slept on them. When the dog was old enough to run and trip down the steps on her own, she took the shoes outside, put them in shallow ditches under the house. She'd stand rigid as a pine when we tried to take them away from her. Now China is giving like she once took away, bestowing where she once stole. She is birthing puppies. What China is doing is nothing like what Mama did when she had my youngest brother, Junior. Mama gave birth in the house she bore all of us in, here in this gap in the woods her father cleared and built on, that we now call the pit. Me, the only girl and the youngest at 8, was of no help, although Daddy said she told him she didn't need any help. Daddy said that Randall and Skeeta and me came fast, that Mama had all of us in her bed, under her own bare burning bulb, so when it was time for Junior, she thought she could do the same. It didn't work that way. Mama squatted, screamed toward the end. Junior came out purple and blue as a hydrangea. Mama's last flower. She touched Junior just like that when Daddy held him over her, lightly with her fingertips, like she was afraid she'd knock the pollen from him, spoil the bloom. She said she didn't want to go to the hospital. Daddy dragged her from the bed to his truck, trailing her blood, and we never saw her again. What China is doing is fighting, like she was born to do. Fight our shoes, fight other dogs, fight these puppies that are reaching for the outside, blind and wet. China's sweating, and the boys are gleaming, and I can see Daddy through the window of the shed, his face shining like the flash of a fish under the water when the sun hit. It's quiet. Heavy. Feels like it should be raining, but it isn't. There are no stars, and the bare bulbs of the pit burn.
Salvage the Bones by Jasmine Ward is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by January Lavoie. And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a modern book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Right now I'm reading a book called Good Morning Means I Love You, which is not out quite yet. But I'll tell you what, I've been rereading Macbeth. I think that's one of my favorites. And I'm not reading much children's books right now because I'm writing, and I try not to read too much while I'm writing, but in terms of children's literature. But man, I'm rereading some Shakespeare stuff like Macbeth and Hamlet, but really Macbeth. And I just think it's a masterpiece, differently than I felt when I was young. I hated it when I was younger. But reading it now, it's almost like every line is exquisite in a way that makes me want to be a better writer. And so I'm in my Macbeth bag right now.
So foul and fair a day I have not seen.
A forest call to forests.
What are these, so withered and so wild in their attire, that look not like the inhabitants of earth and yet are aunt? Live you, or are you aught that man may question? You seem to understand me, by each at once her choppy finger laying upon her skinny lips. You should be women, and yet your beards forbid me to interpret that you are so.
Speak if you can. What are you?
All hail, Macbeth. Hail to thee, Thane of Glamis.
All hail, Macbeth. Hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail, Macbeth. That shalt be king hereafter.
Good sir, why do you start and seem to fear things that do sound so fair? In the name of truth, are ye fantastical, or that indeed which outwardly ye show? My noble partner, you greet with present grace and great prediction, of noble having and of royal hope, that he seems wrapped withal. To me you speak not. If you can look into the seeds of time and say which grain will grow and which will not, speak then to me, who neither beg nor fear your favors nor your hate.
Hail!
Hail!
Lesser than Macbeth and greater.
Not so happy, yet much happier.
Thou shalt get kings, though thou be none. So all hail Macbeth and Banquo.
Banquo and Macbeth, all hail.
Stay, you imperfect speakers, tell me more. By Simon's death, I know I am Thane of Glamis, but how of Cawdor? The Thane of Cawdor lives a prosperous gentleman, and to be king stands not within the prospect of belief no more than to be Cawdor. Say from whence you owe this strange intelligence, or why upon this blasted heath you stop our way with such prophetic greeting. Speak, I charge you!
The earth hath bubbles as the water has, and these are of them. Whither are they vanished?
Into the air. And what seemed corporal melted as breath into the wind. Would they had stayed!
Were such things here as we do speak about? Or have we eaten on the insane route that takes the reason prisoner?
Your children shall be kings.
You shall be king.
And then of Cawdor too. Went it not so?
To the selfsame tune and words. Who's here?
A clip there from the Argo Classic recording of William Shakespeare's Macbeth. The narrators featured include Tony Robinson, Roger Pryor, Tony Church, and Derek Jacobi. It's available from RNIB Talking Books, along with many other Shakespeare plays. And once again, Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.